So thank you everyone for joining us for the third class in Rabbi Dr. Lindsay Taylor Goodhart's series with us here at Torah in Motion on an introduction to Islam. So yeah, I guess we can get started now. Thank you.
There we go. So last week we finished off looking at the biography of the founding figure of Islam, the Prophet Muhammad, and we looked at the four first caliphs or successors and discussed the first civil war in Islam, what's known as the first fitna between the Prophet's cousin and son-in-law, Ali, and the opposition, which was actually led by one of Muhammad's wives, Aisha. So we're going to pick up from there and see what happened next. Because the other thing we also discussed, of course, was the fact that Islam spread enormously, not necessarily on the ground, but the newly enthused warriors of Islam took advantage of the weakness of contemporary empires and established a huge, huge empire that was right across North Africa and right across what's up into what's now Iraq, right through what is now Israel, Egypt, and so on. And so began to, I think it was all a bit faster than they thought. And we left them last week heavily relying on what was happening there before in terms of administration and taxation. So we have to pick that story up this week too and see how did things develop. But we're going to start, as I mentioned, with the relationship of Jerusalem to Islam, because that fits in very nicely. So the Muslim forces took Jerusalem in the year 638 CE. Now, that was the reign of the second caliph, Umar ibn al-Khattab, who reigned from 634 to 644. And they took Jerusalem with no battle whatsoever. There were no Jews living in Israel, in Jerusalem at this point, because the Byzantines, i.e. the late Roman Empire, which was Christian, had actually preserved the Emperor Hadrian's policy of banning Jews from living in Jerusalem. You might remember that after the Bar Kokhba revolt, Jerusalem was leveled, it was rebuilt as Aelia Capitolina, renamed in honor of the Emperor Hadrian, and Jews were banned from living there at all, and that policy had continued. So there were no Jews in Jerusalem whatsoever. So what happened when the Muslims got there? There we are. There's our handout. We have a much, much later report. This is 9th century. So we're talking, a long time, 200 years plus after the events. But this is one of our major sources, because we don't have a lot of sources. So on his return into Jordan, Abu Ubaidah, just besieged the people of Ilia. And in Arabic, that is Ilia. It is one of the Arabic names of Jerusalem. It's based on this Latin name, Aelia Capitolina, which is the holy house. And this is Bait al-Maqdis, which might sound very familiar, Bait al-Mikdash. So this is what they're calling the city. The Muslims are completely aware that there was a temple there. They prolonged their resistance. This is the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the Christian inhabitants of Jerusalem. And Abu Ubaidah wrote to the Caliph Umar to inform him of the delays and of the patience, or maybe better, the endurance of the people of Aelia. Some say that the people of Aelia requested of him that it be the Caliph himself who concluded peace with them. Abu Ubaidah assured himself of their sincerity by demanding of them promises by a solemn treaty. And he then informed Umar, who left for Syria after naming Uthman ibn Affan, who you might remember was the third caliph, as his deputy in Medina. Umar came to the region of Damascus, then he went to the Holy House, took it without struggle, and sent the inhabitants the following written message. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, this is a writing of Umar ibn al-Khattab to the inhabitants of the Holy House. You are guaranteed your life, your goods, and your churches, which will be neither occupied nor destroyed, as long as you do not initiate anything blameworthy. So it seems to be quite a peaceful takeover. And there's no evidence at all at this stage that Jerusalem was a particularly important prize to the Muslim invaders. The Muslims, as we said, knew about the existence of the temple, the Bait al-Maqdis, and they knew that was important to the Jews. And they seem to have been quite careful to locate it and take care of it in quite a respectful manner. There had been the history of the Temple Mount after the destruction of the Second Temple was, you know, the actual platform on which the temple was situated, which of course is still there, the Temple Mount itself, was far too big to destroy. So what tended to happen was bits of it were just not used at all, and occasionally people built stuff up there. So there had been a church up on top of the Temple Mount, but it had been destroyed by the Persians in the early 7th century, roughly the time of Muhammad himself, and it had been left in ruins. So it was an overgrown and unused area at this point. And we have a much, again, much later account from the 14th century of what happened when the Muslims actually entered the ex-temple compound. Now, because it's so late, it's not necessarily historical, and quite a few historians are not absolutely sure that the Caliph Umar himself ever went anywhere near Jerusalem. But okay, this is how later Muslim imagination pictured what happened. On the authority of Al-Walid ibn Muslim, it is reported as coming from a shaykh of the sons of Shaddad ibn Aws, who heard it from his father, who held it of his grandfather. This is the chain of tradition for this statement, that Umar said to the patriarch of Jerusalem, this will be the Christian patriarch of Jerusalem, conduct us to the Mosque of David. Now, in case you just think mosque, well, that you know, they couldn't have thought that David was a Muslim. A masjid, a mosque, is a place of prostration. So in this context, it's not really being used as a specifically Muslim place of worship. It's a place where God is worshipped by prostrating. So that would apply to the temple. And the patriarch agreed thereto. Then Umar went forth girt with his sword, and behind with him 4,000 of the companions who had come to Jerusalem with him. The companions are important in Arab, as-Sahaba, and they are people who knew Muhammad when he was alive, talked to him, lived in the same town, had met him, and had died as Muslims themselves. So that first generation of the Muslim community, and they are thought of as a distinct unit, and they're often referred to in Muslim sources. So to be one of the Sahaba was a very honored position. Descendants of people who were Sahaba is still very important if you can prove it all that way back. So this is some of the pious Muslims who were a part of the original community. They'd obviously gone too. And the patriarch walked before Umar among the companions, and we all came behind the Khalif, behind Umar. Thus we entered the holy city, and the patriarch took us to the church, which goes by the name of the Kumama, the dunghill, and he said, this is David's mosque. And Umar looked around and pondered, and then he answered the patriarch, you lie. For the apostle, Muhammad, described to me the mosque of David, and by his description, this is not it. And the patriarch went on with us to the church of Sion. And again, he said, this is the mosque of David. But the Caliph replied to him, you lie. So the patriarch went on with him till he came to the noble sanctuary, and that's still the Muslim name for the Temple Mount, Al-Qarama Sharif, of the holy city, and reached the gate thereof, afterwards called the Gate Muhammad. Now the dung, or the debris perhaps, which was then all about the noble sanctuary, had settled on the steps of this gate, so that even came out into the street in which the gate opened, and it had accumulated so greatly on the steps as almost to reach up to the ceiling of the gateway. The patriarch said to Umar, it is impossible to proceed and enter except crawling on hands and knees. Said Umar, even on hands and knees, be it. So the patriarch went down on hands and knees, preceding Umar, and we all crawled after him until he had brought us out into the court of the noble sanctuary of the holy city. So they have to make their way through the debris of the blocked gate, and they finally come out on top of the Temple Mount. Then we arose off our knees and stood upright, and Umar looked around, pondering for a long time. Then said he, by him in whose hands is my soul, this is the place described to us by the Apostle of Allah. So he identifies it as the Bayt al-Maqdis, the Holy House. Now, as I said, this is a very late source, and it's doubtful whether Umar was actually there. But this certainly shows that by the 14th century, it was considered a very important place. And there was a certain amount of tradition that the Muslim invaders had known that, had gained access there, apparently in spite of Christian opposition. And there are other traditions that record that Umar began to remove the accumulated rubbish with his own hands and led his followers in clearing the site. So again, there's certainly a later tradition this was seen as an important place. We can also tell that it was seen as an important place because in 692 CE, a somewhat later caliph, Abd al-Malik, commissioned the building of Dome of the Rock there. And that, Den of the Rock, happens to be the earliest example in the world of specifically Islamic architecture, which is quite interesting. The Al-Aqsa Mosque that you will probably know from pictures, which is nearby, was built by Abdul Malik's son, Al-Walid, and that was finished about 705 CE, so it was later. It probably replaced a much smaller mosque that probably had been there since the Muslim conquest of the city. But to go back to the Dome of the Rock, that is a really interesting building because it is so early and it is so unusual. It isn't a mosque. It was never designed to be a mosque. And the question is, what was it meant to be? Because clearly a lot of money was spent in building that. It also has mosaics in it, beautiful, beautiful mosaics. I've never been, but I've seen the pictures, done by Byzantine craftsmen of the time who were busy doing exactly the same sort of mosaics on churches at the period. And the mosaic has inscriptions in Arabic in it. And some of them are the earliest known quotations from the Quran itself. When we do the session on the Quran, we'll find out about manuscripts of the Quran, but none exist that are as old as the Dome of the Rock. So this is our first evidence for the text of the Quran too, which is interesting. And they also include the earliest mention of Muhammad outside the Quran. So altogether, the Dome of the Rock is interesting. Now, much later Muslim tradition says that the building was built over a rock that bore a footprint from Muhammad, from his miraculous night journey to Jerusalem, which is called the Isra, and his ascension from that rock up into heaven, the Miraj. But if that were the reason for building it, or a local tradition that that had happened, it's interesting the inscriptions and the decoration don't refer to this at all. So it seems to be a later tradition. This story of Muhammad's night journey to Jerusalem and his ascension from there to heaven actually comes from an interesting interpretation of a very obscure passage in the Quran. And here is the passage in the Quran, and you'll see it's pretty vague. Glory be to him who made his servant go on a night journey from the sacred mosque, that would be Mecca and the Kaaba, to the remote mosque, Al-Masjid Al-Aqsa. And that is what Al-Aqsa means the remote or the most far mosque, of which we have blessed the precincts, so that we may show to him some of our signs. Surely he is the hearing, the seeing. So that's a Quranic text. And you can see it doesn't really name the place that this night journey goes to. It's just the furthest mosque. It's much later interpretation that identifies that with Jerusalem. But the Quran itself is very, very vague indeed. So again, you might sort of think Midrash. You know, it's a later understanding of this very obscure verse. That doesn't mean to say it's not the faith story now. Of course it's the faith story now, but it's not absolutely clear looking at it from an academic point of view or an outsider's point of view. It doesn't seem to have been an early tradition. It seems to have been a late one. So we're back to that question. If we're not looking from a faith point of view, an internal point of view, what was it for? What was this Dome of the Rock building for? One possibility is it served a political purpose. It was constructed at the time when the Muslim Empire was in the middle of a civil war. Mecca was in the hands of Abdul Malik's rival, somebody called Ibn al-Zubayr. So there were two halves of the Muslim Empire in the 690s, and the supporters of Abd al-Malik couldn't go on Hajj, couldn't go on pilgrimage to Mecca because it was held by the rivals. So Abd al-Malik needed a rival place of pilgrimage, somewhere for his followers to go and feel they were completing something they had to do. So the circular shape of the Dome of the Rock suggests that it was designed to be the focus of a pilgrimage in which people would walk around the sacred rock at the center. And it's designed like that. You can circumambulate the rock, which is actually the bedrock of the Temple Mount, which pokes up in the middle of the Dome of the Rock. You can walk around it just like you are meant to walk around the Kaaba in Mecca when you're on pilgrimage. So it really looks rather like a parallel. However, once again, the inscriptions of the mosque don't call it a place of pilgrimage, and they don't actually refer to that. So what do they say? Because they definitely have a theme. And the theme of the inscriptions is the oneness of God and the fact that God has no son. So here's part of the inscription from Dome of the Rock. It says, O people of the book, which means that this is addressed either to Jews or Christians, do not exaggerate in your religion, nor utter aught concerning God save the truth. the Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, was only a messenger of God and his word, which he conveyed to Mary, and a spirit from him. So believe in God and his messengers and do not say three. Well, obviously, three is a reference to the Christian doctrine of the Trinity. So this is a Muslim attempt to say, Christians, you've got it wrong. Jesus was not the son of God. Messiah doesn't really mean anything terribly in an Islamic context. It could just be seen as a title given to Jesus. And he's being incorporated here as one of many messengers of God, of whom, as we talked about last week, Muhammad is seen as the final messenger of God. So Jesus is being woven in as a prophet here. And he's special because he's a prophet, but he's not special because he's a son of God. This is a warning to Christians not to misinterpret the role of Jesus. I cease talking about God as three. It is better for you. God is only one God. Far be it removed from his transcendent majesty that he should have a son. His is all that is in the heavens and all that is in the earth. And God is sufficient as defender. The Messiah will never scorn to be a servant to God, nor will the favored angels. In other words, not part of God. A servant of God, like other prophets, like other people, like angels, but not part of God. So this really does seem to be very much angled at Christians. And the inscription ends up with a quotation from the Quran, and this is the quoted bit of the Quran. Such is Jesus, son of Mary. This is the saying of truth about which they dispute. It beseems not God that he should take to himself a son, glory be to him. When he has decreed a matter, he only says to it, be, and it is. And surely God is my Lord and your Lord, therefore serve him. This is the right path. So again, this verse of the Quran is an attack on Christian ideas that Jesus is the son of God. Basically says God doesn't need to have sons. If God wants to bring something into existence, he just tells it to exist. The whole idea of God having a son is a ridiculous idea because God doesn't work that way, not a human being. So you can see the connection of these two texts, and you can also see it does really seem to be a very anti-Christian focus. So judging by the inscriptions, the Dome of the Rock is a sort of architectural response and challenge to the Christian inhabitants of Jerusalem. It reminded them who was now in charge. It was built using Byzantine traditions and Byzantine craftsmanship to show that now the new Muslim rulers could outshine the Byzantine emperors. They could build just as well as they could. And it was designed to demonstrate that the new faith was the true one. In addition, it has this sort of quite aggressive message directed to Christians. Jesus is not the son of God. He's just a prophet like other prophets. And to describe God as a trinity is idolatrous. So it seems to be aimed against Christians alone. And that could well reflect the fact that there weren't any Jews in Jerusalem at this point. Or that they was not seen as actually holding problematic beliefs, not on the subject of Jesus or God being in three bits. Jews did settle quite soon after this. Jews did settle again in Jerusalem under Muslim rule. The Muslims saw no reason for keeping them out. So Jews did come back under Muslim rule here. So you can see here the origins of the interest in Islam in Jerusalem. You can see that maybe it's not actually what it, in the beginning, what it has developed into. You can't deny now that it's part of the faith picture, but we can certainly question whether it was actually all that important at the very beginning of Islam and the beginning of Muslim control of this area. It certainly became very important. So that's little sort of excursus on the relationship of Islam to Jerusalem. So having considered the impact and the nature of the early conquests and the gradual spread of Islam as a religion, because we saw that the conquests were much, much faster than the conversions, and there doesn't seem to have been forced conversion. We need to go back to the political events to find out what happened after the death of Ali, who you remember was the fourth of the rightly guided caliphs, this first set of four that certainly Sunni Islam accepts. In a way, the whole of Islamic history from this point on forms part of this search for the perfect Islamic society, complete with the perfect leader. And that really has been going on since the death of Muhammad. And the search includes the vital question of the nature of what exactly are the religious duties and prerogatives of the caliph. Everyone agreed that the ummah, the wide community, should be led by one male Muslim, but everyone disagreed on just about everything else. his qualifications, the way he would be appointed, the nature and extent of his authority, and the grounds for removing him, if you could. Could you remove the caliph? All that was up for grabs, and people had different answers to that. And you could sort of squish them all into one major question. Was the caliph just an ordinary human being in an extraordinary position, a bit like a president or a tribal sheikh? Or should he be an extraordinary man, specially chosen and given special gifts by God, like Muhammad had been in Muslim eyes? And there was a spectrum of possible answers to that question. At one end, you have the caliph as an infallible source of religious guidance, who has authority by virtue of who he is, and whose followers must accept his authority unquestioningly, a sort of prophet model. And this is the position followed by the Shiites. And we'll talk about this in more detail. At the other end of the spectrum, the caliph is just an ordinary human being. His authority derives from his faithfulness to Islamic law. If he made mistakes, or too many mistakes, he could be replaced. And this is much more a tribal leader model. Just, you know, you don't like the bloke, you throw him out the way. And this was the position of the group called the Kharijites, those who had left Ali and walked away from him when they thought he had acted improperly. And a middle position eventually emerged in which the caliph was not seen as infallible, and he didn't have absolute authority, but he did have the only authority around. He alone had the right and responsibility to ultimately decide questions in Islamic law. He was, if you like, top posek, and thus he would ensure the unity of the ummah. And this is much more of a king model. This is the model that became the Sunni response. So we're going to look at those three responses and see how these groups developed. So if we go back to our historical relation, we need to pick up after the death of Ali, who was, if you remember, he was assassinated by Kharijites, who thought he was a bad leader. He had, while alive, been fighting Muawiyah, the governor of Syria, who was the nephew of the third caliph. After Ali was killed, his eldest son, Hassan, decided he didn't want to be in this political game at all. And he sort of abdicated. Not he really was in a position, but he just sort of stepped back from the conflict. And so Muawiyah became caliph. He killed off, or his rival had been killed off. There was not enough opposition. There was opposition, but it wasn't powerful enough to displace him. Ali's supporters, the Shi'at Ali, the party of Ali, still went on supporting him. But Muawiyah had political power. So Muawiyah moved the capital from Medina, or Mecca, it's not actually clear which was the prime city at this time, to Damascus. Why? Well, Damascus was on a lot of trade routes. Damascus is a much better place to control an empire from than Mecca and Medina, which are in this dry peninsula without many resources and a long way away from everywhere else. So if you're going to control a large empire, you want somewhere that has good communications, and it's flat bang in the middle of that empire, and that was Damascus. And the other thing that Muawiyah did was he founded a dynasty. He alienated an awful lot of Muslims by this. They felt that wasn't the right way to choose the leader of the Ummah. You couldn't just have one son after another son after another son. That wasn't proper. But he did found this dynasty. It's known as the Umayyad dynasty. Muawiyah belonged to a clan called Umayyah, so that's why his dynasty has this name. And they maintained their control of the Muslim empire for 90 years. They expanded it all the way to Spain in the west, and Afghanistan and the city of Samarkand in the east. So it was huge. They even launched unsuccessful attacks on Constantinople, nowadays Istanbul, which was the capital of the much reduced Byzantine Empire. So they were very ambitious. Muawiyah employed local Christians, because most of Syria was Christian at this point. It had been part of the Byzantine Empire. And he used them to set up a royal administration and a tax system and a diplomatic bureaucracy. And he ran a huge army, organized provincial administration systems, and he laid the foundations of a religious bureaucracy. So Arabic gradually, but at this point, becomes the official language, and the rate of conversion starts speeding up. We said originally it was quite hard to convert. You had to be officially adopted by somebody who already was a Muslim. But things start speeding up as people realize the Muslims are here to stay, and if you want an upward path in the civil service, you're going to have to become a Muslim. So not everyone actually supported Muawiyah and his Umayyad dynasty. And when he died in 680 CE, a second civil war broke out, known as the Second Fitna. The first one was between Ali and his I think people are drawing on the handout. Maybe don't do that. It's a little bit disturbing. Thanks. So the first one had been between Ali and his rivals. Now this second one is between Muawiyah's descendants, or basically the Umayyad dynasty, and those who were still supporting Ali's family, even though Ali himself was dead. And the Shi'a Ali, the party of Ali, regarded Ali as the second most important figure in Muslim in Islam after Muhammad. And they claimed that Muhammad had appointed Ali as his successor and all Ali's descendants after him. And they based this on a hadith, an oral tradition, known as the hadith of the pond of Gadar al-Qum. And in this hadith, Muhammad had said, "Whomsoever's Mawla I am," and we'll go back to the word Mawla in a moment, "this Ali is also his Mawla. O God, befriend whomsoever befriends him, and be the enemy of whomsoever is hostile to him." Now, how you interpret the word Mawla depends on who you are. Shiites take the word Mawla to mean master, and they take this to be an authentic tradition of Muhammad appointing Ali as master, therefore also Ali's descendants, therefore those are the people who should be the caliph, those are the people who should run the ummah, who should be in ultimate authorities. Sunnis don't translate Mawla as master, they translate it as beloved friend. In other words, Muhammad is very fond of Ali, but didn't put him in a position of authority. And you should have him, you should pray for the soul of Ali, that's fine. But not that he was appointed to anything at all. So opposition to Muawiyah and his Umayyad dynasty centered on Ali's second son, Hussein. You remember that the first son, Hassan, had decided, no, he wasn't going to play this game. So Hussein is the great hope of the party of Ali. And essentially, he didn't last very long either. In 680, he led a small army from Medina up to Kufa, which is in Iraq. But he was killed by an Umayyad army from Syria at Karbala, which is today in Iraq, on the 10th day of the month, Muharram. And that is a day and a place that Shiite Muslims still revere. Karbala is a major, major Shiite shrine and center in Iraq. And all over the world, Shiites hold passion plays dramatizing Hussein's death. And they have public processions. They're in London too, actually. I'm sure that wherever you are, there's a Shiite population anyway near you, they will also have these processions. And they're held on the 10th of Muharram, and it's called Ashura, 10 being Esser, Ashur in Arabic. The other main opponent of the Umayyads, somebody called Ibn Zubayr, was killed in 692. So basically, the Umayyads were really, really entrenched. However, this didn't make the Shiites go away. We'll see how that happens in a moment. So we said that this whole focus on who should be the caliph and who was the right person underlines this major concern of Islam about the right God-guided leadership of the Ummah. We also noted that the term caliph or khalifa means deputy. And there was a sort of dispute about what the phrase was, deputy of whom? So it could have been Khalifat Allah, the deputy of God. Later Muslim scholars claimed the correct form was Khalifat Rasul Allah, the deputy of the messenger of God. And there are some theological differences here that are important for the Sunni-Shia divide. So the first version, the deputy of God, implies that the caliph is God's voice on earth and has divine authority. The second version, the deputy of the messenger of God, just says, okay, you know, the caliph is the steward of Muhammad's legacy. And it's important to know that the caliphs themselves tended to claim the first version, the more authoritative version. And most of the people who fought to be caliph passionately believed that they were indeed speaking for God and administering his law, and that if they were rejected, the people who rejected them were rejecting God himself. And Shiites feel that very strongly still. So because they supported Ali and his descendants, the Shiites still feel that the murder of Hussein at Karbala is tantamount to leaving Islam, it's apostasy for them. And this is the source of the very bitter hatred between Shiites and Sunnis for, well, the best up to modern times. It depends when and where, but it's a long-lasting animosity that can flare up with violent results at many different times. And if we remember the three models we talked about, Caliph, the prophet model, which is the Shiite model of the divinely appointed and inspired leader, the tribal leader model, the one who is only in power and does the right thing and can be deposed, and then the compromise, the Sunni compromise between the two of the king, we can again see this playing out in history. So the Shiites go with the prophet model. And for them, up to today, the only true leaders of the Muslim Ummah have to be descendants of Ali. And they have a whole series of them. They're called the imams. Now, imam is quite a general term. It means leader. So you can have an imam of prayer, which is just the person who's leading prayers, like a Ba'atikilah or Shliach Tzibur. But when used by Shiites, the imams are these particular descendants of Ali who they recognize as leaders. Now, in practice, this didn't work out well. Here is a table of the 12 imams who are accepted by 12 Shiites. That's the form of Shiism that's predominant in Iran. And you can see they mostly come to bad ends. We saw that Ali was assassinated by a Kharijite. His son Hassan abdicated and later on got poisoned by the Umayyads. His second son Hussein was killed at Karbala, as we just said. His son lived quietly and was poisoned by the Umayyads, and so on and so forth. So we'll refer back to these as we just look at what happens here. So every now and then they would have a rebellion against the Umayyads and then later their successors, but they kept being crushed, and rebellion after rebellion by the supporters of Ali's descendants was completely squashed. And in face of this political failure, Shiites adopted two major strategies which were determined by their attitude to who was the rightful caliph. The first strategy was just to shut up and be quiet and sit down and wait for God's good time, when presumably God would restore the proper imam to his place. The other reaction tends to be military action. So you have these two extremes of the way Shiites tended to react to Sunni dominance. And most of them did go underground and choose the road of quietism after and followed some of the examples set by some of the imams. And you can see several of them lived quietly or were legal scholars. So several of the imams themselves just said, you know, that's not fast. You know, I know I'm the imam, but let's just be quiet about it and I won't do any challenging. And the feeling was, the teaching was that the imams had special knowledge, ilm, that was hidden from ordinary beings. They were mystical people who were inspired directly by God, and they could understand the hidden meanings of the Quran. And a whole way of reading the Quran for its hidden meanings developed, rather like the way, of course, a whole tradition of reading Torah with its hidden meanings developed in Judaism. So in order to protect the imams and continue to follow them, the Shiites decided it was permissible to conceal their true beliefs. And this doctrine of concealment or dissimulation, it's called taqiyya, is still around. There's this idea that if you're in a situation where people might kill you, you can deny your beliefs and survive for another day. And Sunnis see Shiites as deceptive for this reason. Shiites would say, no, we're not being deceptive, we're just staying alive because you are so horrible and persecute us. Not all Shiites accepted this idea of being quiet and just simulating and not getting into trouble. Some of them said no, we should fight. The sixth imam, Ja'far al-Sadiq, had an uncle who led an unsuccessful rebellion. He was called Zaid, and some people followed him and abandoned the tradition of Ja'far al-Sadiq as the next imam. He died in Kufa in 740, so it didn't really work. But his followers started a breakaway branch. And you can see it here. His brother Zaid starts a breakaway branch. So there they're known as Zaidis. They're still around too. They were at the time a much more militant sect than the opposition. They believed the only true imams were the people who fought to take power. They still exist, especially in Yemen. And actually recently, the whole war in Yemen, it's between Zaydis and non-Zaydis. So this is where they came from. They were often the most moderate and free-thinking Shiite sect, but it'll change in time and place. Also, like most Sunnis, they don't believe that the imam is infallible. And they're not too sure about occultation. We'll come up to occultation in a moment. But again, Zionists, you know, you can see where they come from. It doesn't necessarily mean that they espouse exactly the same beliefs in the 21st century. But this is where the Zionists in Yemen come from. They come from this different branch of Shiism. And after the death of Ja'far as-Sadiq, there's another split in Shiism. This is the problem. If there are more than one brother, then some people say, well, I think this brother is the Imam. And other people say, I think this brother is the Imam. And you get a split. So Shiism has quite a lot of subgroups, depending on whose ancestors went with which Imam. So most of the Shiites accepted the son of Ja'far as-Sadiq as the seventh Imam, Musa'l Kazim, and most of them went according to him and followed the quietist tradition. And this is the path that leads to 12 Shiites who accept these 12 Imams. For them, the sequence ends with Muhammad al-Mahdi, who disappeared and in 874. And they interpreted or rationalized, if you like, his disappearance as he was concealed by God. And this is known as the Ghaiba, the occultation. And they expect him to come back. So it's a messianic faith, which is quite interesting. And there are documented instances in Iran, or particularly during the Iran-Iraq War, of Iranian soldiers having visions of the Mahdi leading them to victory. So he's still quite a present force. But there weren't any imams after him. For several decades, he continued to communicate with his followers, or they believed he was communicating with them, through a series of official representatives called the Babs, which means the door or the gate. But in 941, he went completely silent, what's known as the Greater Occultation. And 12 was, say, believed he will come back one day. And the gap left by the absence of an imam on earth was filled by religious scholars who decide law. And the Twelvers, this group is the group that's dominant in Iran, as I said. Very unusually, as we know in recent years, the scholars have assumed political power. And that was something they never, never did before on theological grounds, on the ground that only the imam can have political powers. So there have been some quite revolutionary developments in Twelver Shiism in recent years, which is, again, very, very interesting. So this big split that's around here, around the seventh imam, the other branch followed the brother of Musa al-Kazim, who's called Ismail. And this is the origin of the Ismaili Muslims, Shiites, who you might have heard about too. They thought that Ismail was the next imam and his son Muhammad was the eighth imam, and they believe him to be the Mahdi. So there was a lot of bad blood between 12 Shiites and 7 Shiites. They didn't talk to each other much. And they were quite an active group. They went out sending missionaries all over the place to India and North Africa, and they established groups all over the Muslim world. And they came out as quite powerful political players in the 9th and 10th centuries. A branch called the Qamartis, who were Ismailis, established states in Syria and Arabia, and they controlled most of Yemen by year 905. Another branch emerged in North Africa and established the Fatimid dynasty that took over Egypt and ruled what is now Israel, and in fact ran one of the great Islamic empires at its height. It went all the way from North Africa through Syria, Sicily, Egypt, Syria, much of Arabia. They actually controlled Mecca and Medina at this point. They lasted till 1171, when Salah ad-Din, who you might know better in history as Saladin, crushed that dynasty. But they were an Ismaili dynasty. And there are other Shiite factions that we don't have time go into, and then it gets very confusing. Particularly interesting, actually, are the Nizari Ismailis, who were notorious in the Middle Ages. The term assassin comes from them. They were called the Khashashin. There were legends that they had specially trained hitmen who imbibed large quantities of marijuana and went out maddened by the drug to kill people. A lot of this was mythology, I think. But they actually survived today, rather surprisingly, as the followers of the Aga Khan. And for them, the Aga Khan is their 49th imam. They're terribly peaceful and promote a lot of cultural interreligious activities. But again, they weren't always. About 12, 15 million of them today. So again, the followers of the Aga Khan are a branch of Ismaili Shiites, very different from the 12 Shiites of Iran. So the Shiites themselves are a fascinating group, but tend to splinter because of this history of different imams. In fact, they have brothers. So that's one end of the spectrum, the prophet end. If we move to the other end, the leader or the caliph should just be an ordinary human being. And if he makes mistakes, you just remove him, the Kharijite position. What happened there? Well, we saw the Harijites first when they left Ali, when he tried to negotiate with enemies, and we thought that was absolutely not okay. They walked out on him. Their slogan was, La hukm ila lillahi, judgment belongs to God alone. They opposed Ali, they opposed Muawiyah, they opposed absolutely everybody. They assassinated Ali in 661. They engaged in guerrilla warfare against the Umayyad dynasty. And they split into several factions, not at all surprisingly, because the moment you disagreed with the leader, you know, there would be two groups of them. So there are a lot of little Harijite groups all over the place. They controlled different places in different parts. A more moderate group called the Ibadis are still around. They are really the only Harijite group that survived in modern times, and they are the dominant sect in Oman. So if you go to Oman, it's an Ibadi country. And they're very much into interfaith, actually. I have been on religious summer school interfaith things with Ibadi Muslims from Oman. There are still some Ibadis also in Algeria and Libya. They don't see themselves as Harijites, which is usually a rude name these days. The Sunnis see them as Harijites. And again, Harijite is now a word that's thrown around as an insult in the Muslim world, but nobody will own up to having a Harijite history, even if they really, really do. So one of the few beliefs that all these little splinter groups of the Harijites held in common was that anybody could be the caliph. A slave could be the caliph as long as he was very pious and was accepted by the community. And they had a very minimalist position. They only accepted the first two caliphs, Abu Bakr and Umar, as legitimate, and the first 6 years of the third caliph, Uthman, then they thought he fell into error. They don't accept anyone else's caliph, mostly. Okay. So having looked at both ends, the prophet end, the Shiite end, the just a human being who can be removed end, the Harijite end, now we're going to come back to that middle position, which is really what won out. It's known as the Sunni compromise, the king position. And this we see with the development after the Umayyads of the Abbasid dynasty, the next big enormous and very, very important dynasty in Muslim history. The Abbasid dynasty replaced the Umayyads in 750 CE, and they didn't follow the Shiite model, and they didn't follow the Harijite model. They actually rather sneakily got into power by using Shiite support. The leader or the candidate for being caliph was descended from the Prophet Muhammad's uncle, who was called Al-Abbas, hence the name Abbasid. So that was quite attractive to the Shiites, because the Shiites were all about you had to be related to Muhammad. So this bloke was. And from their base in Kufa, they sent missionaries off to Khorasan, which is an area now sort of northeast Iran, bits of Afghanistan, southern bits of Central Asia. And they proclaimed the coming of the preferred one from the house of Muhammad, and all the local Shiites rose up in support of this rather vaguely named candidate. So it was a brilliant propaganda move. It got Shiite support right behind the Abbasids, and it worked. And in 750, the Abbasids and their supporters swept the Umayyads out of power, except for one prince who escaped off to Spain and set up a quite long-running little tiny mini Umayyad dynasty there. But once the Abbasids got into power and their candidate, Abu al-Abbas al-Safa, had become caliph, the Shiites realized that their candidate, the sixth Imam, Ja'far al-Sadiq, was not going to be the caliph, as they had presumably thought from that nicely, vaguely worded message saying the one from the house of Muhammad was going to be caliph. And basically, the Abbasids dropped their pretenses and murdered as many of the Shiite leaders as they could. And the Shiites to this day believe that all their imams from number 7 on were poisoned by Abbasids. So either you're poisoned by an Umayyad if you're pre-Abbasid, or you're poisoned by an Abbasid if you're post-Abbasid. So Shiites are an angry set of people, religiously speaking. So the Abbasids have depended very, very heavily on Persians in their rise to power. And partly in response to this, the second Abbasid caliph moved the capital from Damascus to Baghdad, which was a new city, which they founded in 762 on the Tigris River, obviously in Iraq. And that caliph also welcomed non-Arab Muslims to court. There'd been a bit of a sort of slightly racist thing about Arab Muslims, the top Muslims, and everybody else, well, not so sure about them. But he was much more encouraging. And he inaugurated a golden age in the Islamic world, in which science and philosophy and theology grammar, literature, medicine, mathematics, and other fields absolutely flourished. And they established a sort of proto-university in Baghdad called the Bayt al-Hukum, the House of Wisdom. And they tried to collect all the world's knowledge there. One of the results of this was that all sorts of Greek and Latin classical works that would have been destroyed, because Europe was certainly not appreciating them in the 750s, they were translated into Arabic and they were preserved in Arabic. And that's how we have them today, because the Abbasids collected things like that. There's a link to Jewish history. The great yeshivas of Sura and Pumbedita moved to Baghdad. They stopped being actually in Sura and Pumbedita, which were little, you know, one horse towns somewhere on the Tigris and Euphrates. They went off to what the seat of power in Baghdad for their later years. And the head of the Jewish community, the exilarch, who claimed to be descended from King David and had a little mini state really within the Abbasid Empire, like he had privileges almost of a subject king, he had his seat in Baghdad too. And all sorts of things happened. They imported paper making from China. Also, the making of gunpowder was imported from China. And you may well have heard of the figure Harun al-Rashid. You might have thought he was a character out of the Arabian Nights. No, he was one of the caliphs. He was an Abbasid caliph. He reigned 786 to 809. And there was a huge age of real intellectual achievement there. And a lot of use of previously existing administrative techniques modeled basically on the previous Persian Sasanian Empire. They just took over the bureaucracy and reworked it. And one Abbasid caliph even said, "The Persians ruled for 1,000 years and did not need us Arabs even for a day. We have been ruling them for 1 or 2 centuries and we cannot do without them for an hour." So they were quite conscious that they had taken these administrative arts from the people they had conquered. They adopted the political theory of the Sasanians, the bureaucratic methods, and essentially the caliph turned into a king modeled on a Sasanian king. And again, this compromise between the two extremes of a prophet or a tribal leader. And a great scholar, Abu Hassan al-Mawadi, who died in 1058, actually enshrined this compromise position in his book, The Rules of Governance. And he based it on the Hadith literature, because you had to for religious authority. But he used the Hadith to discredit both the Shiite position and the Kharijite position. So here's a little example from it. The Prophet said, "He who obeys me obeys God. He who disobeys me disobeys God. He who obeys the ruler obeys me. He who disobeys the ruler disobeys me." That's a fabulous foundation for an absolute monarch, basically, you know, as in Europe, tying obedience to the king to obedience to God and obedience to Muhammad. "You will hear and obey the prince, even if he beats your back and steals your property. They, the rulers, will be judged for what they do, and you will be judged for what you do. Whoever abandons the ruling power and separates from the general body of believers and then dies a pagan." So in other words, if you want to be a proper Muslim, you have to obey the king. That's part of your duty as a Muslim, and that is enshrined in traditional literature, certainly associated with Muhammad, we should say. You know, whether Muhammad actually said some of these things, who knows? But certainly quoted as saying that. So this meant that really the Shiite position of loyalty to the House of Ali was completely squashed. It didn't matter what your descent was. If you were not the caliph, then clearly, you know, God didn't want you as a caliph. It also squashed the Kharijite idea that you had to be a certain type of Muslim. You had to be acceptable to the people you ruled. And you could be chucked out if you didn't. Squash that too. So it's very, very much, in many ways, it's quite similar to the contemporary ideas in Europe of the king as a God-given figure and a dynastic figure. So the Abbasids also ran a dynasty that ran for years until the Mongols invaded, which we shall get to next week. And that Sunni compromise ended up as the majority position in Islam, not without enduring conflict about really how this is going to work and who was the correct caliph and how should the caliph be chosen. But it has influenced the whole development of Islam, this idea that the caliph is an authoritative figure but doesn't necessarily have to be a prophetic figure. The other thing that was added to it, perhaps, was the Sunni insistence, or maybe even you could see it as some sort of gesture in the direction of the Shiites, that a caliph had to descend from the Quraishi tribe, and that was the tribe of Muhammad. Not necessarily from Muhammad's immediate family, he didn't have to be a direct descendant of Muhammad, but he had to be from the same tribe. And again, of course, one of the things that led to was the faking of genealogies for various caliphal candidates who then, of course, had to construct nice family trees showing that, of course, they were descended from the Quraysh. I'm going to turn to questions now and see how we're doing on those. So Dome of the Rock is the second major religious site that the early Muslims repurposed from other Saqqara, being the first. Indeed, yes. Question, was there any internal Muslim discussion then and now about how disrespectful this was or is? Was this conscious successionism? No, to the Muslim mind, it was the reclaiming of original sacred sites. In the case of the Kaaba, they understood the Kaaba to have been built by Abraham, and later to have been defiled by idols. So in Muslim eyes, Muhammad cleaned and purified the Kaaba from the later idolatrous accretions and returned it to the state in which Abraham had left it. So they didn't see it as successionism or supersessionism. They saw it as a return to pure origins. And I think similarly, probably at this period, I don't know that they worked it out, because I honestly think that the Temple Mount only became more important later on. But again, you could apply it the same way. If David is a prophet, and David, we think Solomon, but, you know, a slight confusion between David and Solomon. And David constructed a place to worship God that was holy. And certainly these Christians have come along, and, you know, the Romans had destroyed it, and the Christians have built a church up there where they worship Jesus as God. That's clearly not okay. So if you came along and restored that sacred site to the worship of the one true God, you were going back to what David had wanted. So you weren't superseding anything. You were going back to what had originally been there in Muslim self-understanding. Now, of course, Jews might not understand it that way, but that's certainly how Muslims did, I imagine, at that time, understand it as a process of return to origins, return to pure monotheism as invented by the prophets, of whom they had somewhat wider idea than Jews did. So it was quite a successful model, really. You know, they worked quite nicely. Certainly better than the Christian model of, you don't understand your own scriptures and we'll show you, because, you know, Jesus, really, you were just the lead up to Jesus and now you don't matter at all, which was the contemporary Christian view of Judaism. The Muslim view was a much more embracing one that said, yes, of course your prophets are prophets. Of course you have the scripture. And now we have the final prophet who is in yours too. But, you know, we just want to share with you your prophetic tradition. What a shame you don't actually accept our very lovely and God-given last prophet. So you can see, again, it's a different line of cleavage there. Where were the Jews in Palestine, if not in Jerusalem, during the time of the Dome of the Rock? Tiberias was a major center. Tiberias was a very, very Jewish city. A lot of Jews in the Galilee. I don't know if Yavne was still a big center at this point. I'm not sure at all. But one of the ways to find this out would be to look at the location of synagogues at this time. A huge amount of synagogues have been dug up in Israel. You can see them 3rd, 4th, 5th century. So you would look for the 7th century synagogues or modifications to early synagogues. Now, we do know that the Jewish population under the Byzantines, roughly from, you know, probably beginning of the 300s, had declined enormously. This may be one reason why the Jerusalem Talmud, which actually was not written in Jerusalem, it's written in the Galilee, but it may be one of the reasons that it is smaller than the Bavli, than the Babylonian Talmud, and covers fewer tractates, possibly seen, could be linked to the decline of the Jewish community in the 4th century, because that's when the Jerusalem Talmud stops being written, and when the Sanhedrin, it's very difficult to know historically exactly what happens to the Sanhedrin, but the patriarch in Jerusalem, in the land of Israel, seems also, that office seems to have disappeared at about this time. So it's a moot point whether that's because of Byzantine persecution or whether Jews just felt happier elsewhere. It's not absolutely clear what happens, but we do see a decline well before the Muslims turn up. There were still Jews there, but there weren't as many of them at the time. But synagogues would be a very good way of tracking where they were. And I think my instinct is they're all up in Galilee. Well, mostly up in Galilee, not exclusively. Since the Shiites want blood succession from Ali, why such a problem with the Ismailis who are, I'm not sure what you mean by blood succession, if you mean a succession by descent. Well, yes, the Ismailis are Shiites. There are different brands of Shiites. 12 are Shiites, follow a particular line of imams, ending with Muhammad al-Mahdi. And Ismailis follow a different set of imams. They go sideways at Musa al-Karim. Instead of him, they want his brother, Ismail. And so basically, it's a difference in what is the true succession of the imam. And that's how Shiites, Christian, you know, that's how they develop into groups. It's, you know, this man is not the imam, his brother is the imam, and I'm following him. And then you get a new group of Shiites. Of course, there aren't any imams currently around, except for the Aga Khan, who is the 49th imam for that particular branch of the Ismailis. But that's why you get different groups within the within the Shiite world. So you do have a whole load of Shiites who aren't necessarily talking to each other or who don't accept the same set of imams at all. And it goes along the genealogical paths of who is seen as the true imam as opposed to the fake imam. Toronto's the largest Ismaili Muslim centre. Yeah, they're very nice Ismailis. All the ones I've met, anyway. Very into religious dialogue. Didn't anyone notice or wonder that so many of the religious and political leaders were murdered? There's a natural succession in history. Yes. Well, again, you know, back then, no autopsies. So your beloved leader dies and immediately everyone says he was poisoned. Was he poisoned? You don't know. Maybe he got the plague. You know, maybe he had gangrene on his foot that wasn't treated. Maybe he had a heart attack. But it was always interpreted as he was poisoned by the opposition. So I don't think at this stage of history we can actually tell. But you can know what contemporaries believed. And they always believed that he was the true imam was poisoned by his enemies. It's part of the story. Historically, who knows? We don't really know anything about the imams except what Shiite literature tells us. We don't have contemporary documents, as far as I know, that record anything at all about the imams. So, you know, the historicity of their deaths is just undeniable. If Muslims are killing one another, how come the Byzantine Empire and the Persian Empire didn't take advantage and destroy the Muslim Empire? Well, the Persian Empire had already been destroyed. That was it. So there wasn't a Persian Empire around anymore because the Muslims had taken it over. The Byzantine Empire did survive. There was a permanent hot frontier with the Muslims up sort of North Iraq, Armenia, around about there. And that went backwards and forwards and forwards and backwards. There were also, North Africa was a scene of fighting, and the Byzantine Empire went up and down. There were huge amounts of campaigns. But gradually over time, the Byzantines retreated and retreated and retreated until in 1453, the very last place in the Byzantine Empire, Constantinople, Istanbul, was captured by the Ottoman Turks, and that was the end of the Byzantine Empire. But by that stage, it was just Byzantine, it was just the city itself. And it's, you know, if you look at the history of the Byzantine Empire, the Byzantines were also fighting the Bulgarians. They were also fighting all sorts of people at the same time. They had plenty of enemies, and the Muslims were just one set of enemy. And yeah, here and there they made disastrous decisions, and here and there circumstances changed. And the decline of the Byzantine Empire is quite an important part of the story of the rise of Islam, because it tended, not all of the Byzantine Empire became Muslim. Of course, in the West, you have the rise of the Holy Roman Empire, which is the Western part of the ex-Roman Empire, and its successor states like medieval France and so on. And it's a different story there. That's a huge, huge story. It's a job I wouldn't want, leader of the Islamic Empire. Well, the question is, if you want to be the leader of any empire, because you're terribly vulnerable. Also concerns the eternal tribal nature of the Arabs. Well, I would say of human beings. Human beings. You think that many wars in Western Europe? You don't think that you know, the Angles and the Saxons didn't fight? You think that you just look at the history of mankind, you see, everybody fights all the time. So I don't think it's special to the Arabs. And the splitting of fusion, if you look at the Protestant Revolution and how the Protestants split into 151 tiny little sects and still continue to do so, it's by no means unique to Islam. Joe's pretty good at splitting. There's just fewer of us, but give us the numbers, and I'm sure we could do a very good job on splitting and, you know, fighting each other. Yeah, we're pretty good at that too. Northern Kingdom of Israel also suffered kings being killed by future successor. Yes, absolutely. No wonder official food tasters. Indeed. Most kings did. Medieval European kings did as well. And Judah had some pretty rapid successions before Babylon came. Yep. Lots of dynastic, think of Ahab, who is a usurper and kills off the previous royal family. Look at the history of Queen Atalia in the Bible, who kills off all sorts of members of the Judean royal family. And King Josiah is spirited off as a child and hidden, eventually reemerges. Oh, yes, very much. Maybe there's less in the Torah of succession, Genesis and afterwards. A bit messy after Solomon, extremely messy after Solomon. Ruling without wisdom and God doesn't lead to stability. Yeah, we've never really tried ruling with wisdom and God, haven't we? I think humans don't do it. If Muhammad cleaned the Kaaba, why is it still believed to have 300? Who believes it has 360 idols in? You can see very nice YouTubes of the inside of the Kaaba. There's nothing in there at all. It's empty. I don't know where you got the idea of 360 idols. There are Muslim traditions that when he cleaned it, there was an idol for every day of the year, which might argue 365, depending what calendar you're using. But he cleaned them out. And as far as I know, there's been nothing in the Kaaba since. You get onto YouTube and say Kaaba inside of, and you can see a very nice video. It was the time of the assassins, the Hashishin. They were about 1058 to 12 something, and they hold up in a mountain fortress called Alamut. And there's wonderful mythology around them about nobody was safe. You know, they would emerge from their mountain fortress, which was controlled by a figure known as the Old Man of the Mountain. And he would send out his assassins, and they would strike all over the world. I think most of this was mythology. I'm sure there was a load of people holed up at Alamut, but I don't quite know that they had all-powerful assassins. But there was this amazing mystique about them in the later Middle Ages, and that's how the word assassin got into European languages, because it was all attributed to these Hashishin, who were madly high on drugs and did anything. So I don't think actually it was quite as impressive in reality, but there definitely was a group up in that area at that time, the Nizari Ismailis. And they are an interesting group. And again, you know, look them up in Wikipedia or something, and you'll find some very interesting stuff. And oh yes, a very good point. We have a good split between Judea and the Northern Kingdom of Israel, who followed a usurper, and the Southern Kingdom of Judah, who followed King Solomon's son. So yeah, we're pretty good at splitting too. Yeah. And any other questions? Are we there on the questions? So there we are. Fantastic. So I will see you next week. We're going to jump forward more to these. We'll do the Mongol invasions when the Muslim empire by this stage empires is attacked both from the west and the east and goes through a crisis. And then in the 16th century sees a new three empires. So that's what we're going to do next week and have a look at that. So see you then, everybody.
Yes, looking forward. Thank you.
Thank you.